You're listening to the Denver Real Estate Investing Podcast, where it's all about helping you grow your Denver real estate portfolio. Here's your host, Chris Lopez.
Hey, everyone. Welcome back to another episode. So today has got a familiar voice on this podcast, and that is Terrence Doyle. Terrence, good to have you back.
Chris, thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
So if you guys have been listening to the podcast on a regular basis, you've definitely heard Terrence before coming here talking about his story as he got into fix and flipping, moved on to doing apartment buildings, doing some out-of-state investing. And so what Terrence is coming on today to talk about is actually how he underwrites deals. And we're actually going to be looking at, I think, one of the a multifamily property that you're currently under contract on.
It's a deal that we're negotiating. It's been a 3-month negotiation, so we're going back and forth, and we're just patiently waiting for the seller to wake up and realize he wants to sell the building at our price.
Ooh, that sounds interesting. So back up a little bit. Give us a backstory on there. Like, just in general on finding deals, because this is a multifamily apartment building. So right. This is, you know, these deals usually take longer to put together than a house or duplex or whatever. Just kind of walk us through the basic process.
Yeah, I think the key ingredient to multifamily versus single family is just patience. You know, coming out of single family flips, I mean, when I started back in 2008, you know, we were showing up with cashier's checks at a public trustee sale and buying them within 24 hours of going and driving them, you know, so it was speed, speed, speed. And same thing with foreclosures, door knocking. I mean, everything was just someone's in distress. You have to move quickly because if you don't move, someone else is going to buy it. That's the single family game. And I think that that just doesn't apply in multifamily. It's very rare to find someone that's distressed to the point where they're in foreclosure and they need to sell quickly. And light speed in multifamily would be like 35 or 40 days. I mean, that'd be like light speed. When you're talking like 20, 30, 40 units in Denver, where you're talking a $3, $4, $5 million purchase. I mean, there's just so many more hoops and so much more due diligence. So patience is the key, especially in this environment. Like we were talking before we started the podcast. I mean, rates are down, rents are up. All of the stats and all of the data all around the country for jobs and migration and everything is just trending in the right direction. And so it's difficult to find deals right now. Even if you're just finding, even just to find a 6 or 7 cap in Denver is very difficult. And obviously we're trying to do much better than that because it's what we do full time. So yeah, you just patience. So I think the average time we spend, you know, a deal is probably 6 months to a year to get it. You know, the one we did that you saw me, I mean, you were there the day I walked it in the Highlands last year, it took us 8 months. There was a deal in Des Moines that we purchased in January. I would have been working on since 2016. You know, that's kind of an exaggerated example, but yeah, just patience is the key. I think once you identify someone that you know is a seller and you have an inside track on it, and from there, it's just chipping away.
And when you're giving these timelines, this isn't necessarily time frames under contract. This is just like the pre-contract negotiations back and forth. Hey, here's where we're at. Here's where you're at. Where can we meet?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And it kind of takes them waking up one day and some combination of a life event. You know, maybe they're going through a divorce. Maybe someone in their family has an illness, or maybe they just had a tenant that just pissed them off and pushed them over the edge. And they're like, you know what? I don't really want to be a landlord anymore. Let's sell. You know, it's any combination of that. Most of the time it's the third. I think a lot of what I'm seeing right now is people have owned something for 20, 30 years. They don't have the money to renovate and they're just tired of being a landlord and they're tired of tenants and they're tired. And they're just like, take this headache off my hands, please. You know? Yeah.
All right, well, let's dive into the spreadsheet. And I realized I gave you a really quick introduction, and I assume a lot of people know who you are listening to the podcast. Not necessarily true. So quick recap. Again, Terrence Doyle here. I think this is the fourth time you've been on the podcast, third or fourth time. And we flipped hundreds of homes in the last 10 years or so, built a great real estate investing business here in Denver. And now they focus on buying apartment buildings in Denver to reposition them, basically flip apartment buildings, and they have a bunch of long-term holds in Des Moines, Iowa, where they've done some value-add stuff. So if you guys want more details on that, definitely look for Terrence's previous podcast episodes with me. And the reason I wanted to have Terrence come on here to talk about his underwriting stuff, because I've seen a lot of his projects. I know a lot of the inner workings of his business. He's out there very active. He's doing these deals, and you are the type of person I like to learn from.
Thanks, man. Thanks for having me. Yeah, I've been, like you said, I started out single family flips 2008. I didn't really understand it. I started doing it full time on my own in 2014. And I think, you know, the evolution has been, you know, single family flips are great, but I really enjoy the multifamily game. I love the cash flow. I like the ability to, you know, even if a property's not on the market to sell, I'm making money every month. And with a flip, you don't make money until the day it closes. I also like that you can accomplish a lot more only having to drive to one property. So there's a number of reasons, but this is pretty much what we do full time now. And like you said, because the values increase so rapidly in Denver, you know, we're able to buy, renovate, stabilize, hold for 12 to 18 months, let it season, sell it, and take those gains and invest them long-term into Des Moines where we can get a higher return. You know, most of the time in Des Moines, we're getting 10, 12, 13% returns where you just can't find that in Denver. And we can buy larger properties, 50, 70, 80, 100 unit properties. Whereas in Denver, it's just not, it's very, very difficult to do that. So that's kind of been our strategy, and that's what we do. So, you know, the last 2 years, I've really been kind of practicing underwriting a lot. And I know that's a hot topic. I think you and I always talk about, there's so many different masterminds, so many different Facebook groups, so many classes and seminars all about multifamily, buying multifamily, syndicating multifamily. So we thought it might be something interesting for the listeners to see how we underwrite and some of what we've learned in the last couple of years.
Great. And so we got a spreadsheet pulled up. I know if you're listening to this, you can't see it. If you go to the show notes, we'll put the YouTube recording up of it as well, along with some screenshots, so you can go back there and see it. You know, it's not a super complex spreadsheet, but we'll definitely go through and read you the line items and go through the numbers mm-hmm. that they go through. And I'm going to ask a bunch of questions because I want to learn how you do this. All right, so this is a pro forma spreadsheet for this property in Denver.
In Denver, yep. So this is a property we're actively working on, so we won't give the address. It's 30 units. And it's got a really cool design to the building. It's outdated. I don't think it's been updated in 20 years. I mean, when we've done two walkthroughs, and it's one of those things where the roof looks like it probably hasn't been touched, no new windows, landscaping looks pretty rough. There's trash everywhere. And, you know, when you walk through the units, the floor is kind of like peeling. Some of the cabinets are falling apart. The bathroom caulking is like blackish brown. It's one of those, you know, I'm trying to paint the picture. This is what this building looks like. So for us, it's perfect because that's what we want to do, is we want to buy buildings with problems. So other people in a different situation or season in life may be looking for something more turnkey, and that would not be this property. So that's what it is. It's 30 units. It's three studios, 11 one beds, and 16 two bedrooms.
I'm assuming market or rents are well below market with the
well below market. Mostly, yes, well below market. So right now, their studios are going for $700, and this is a suburb of Denver. So the studios are $700, one bedrooms are $900, and two bedrooms are $1,100. But anywhere really in the Denver metro, that's significantly under market, and so that just tells you kind of the condition of the units. So what we do, you know, when I'm my first step is I tried to break this down into three steps, but the first thing, if you're going to underwrite, is you want to ask for the, they call T12, just trailing 12-month financial. So a profit and loss statement on the financials of the building. Any landlord or property manager should have that. If they don't, you should either run or it's probably a deal. So you either run or pursue it for harder because they're unsophisticated and they probably don't know what to do.
Yeah, I was going to say, because I know you buy a lot of your stuff off market right. from, you know, motivated sellers for even apartment buildings. And like, I can't imagine if someone's needs to sell the property quickly because it's poorly run, poorly managed, they're not going to have great financials to share, I would imagine.
A lot of the time we don't get a profit and loss. So we're having to build our own, but it's a good fundamental for the listeners out there that want to learn more. The first question should always be, let me see the financials. If they don't have them, then you're going to need to create them. And then along with that, you want to see a rent roll. You want to see who the tenants are, how long they've been in there, and what they're paying.
So what paperwork did you get from these sellers?
So we did not get a rent roll yet, but we've been in enough units. We kind of know what it looks like. And they actually don't even have a really good rent roll. They said they were going to have to put it together, and we're still waiting on it, which means they don't have one. They did have somewhat of a profit and loss statement, but it was something like on the back of a napkin. So not a lot. So this is what we put together. So the first thing I do is I get the rent roll, and then I will do, so once I see what they're renting for, then I will do a rent study on that area. So before I go anywhere, I'm going to do a rent study. And I recommend, right now I just use Hotpads, but when I started out, I was using Hotpads, Zillow, and apartments.com. And I would, And what's interesting about underwriting apartments is people think that, you know, like when you're selling a home or buying or selling a home, sometimes you can look at a radius of like a mile or half mile. And what's interesting about apartments is it's hyper local. So a half mile will not get it done. You could look at something that an apartment building a half mile away and the rents are completely different.
Really? Even if it's a similar property, similar condition?
It's so hyper local. That is one of the big things that I've learned is you have to really look at the street, what's around the street. Because for instance, like one of the properties you helped one of your clients buy was right across the street from a high school, down the street from a cool shopping center, Stanley Marketplace. So that's going to be trade differently than something that's 8 blocks away that people can't walk their kids to school and can't walk to a coffee shop, right?
It makes that big of a difference in the rents when you're doing
completely different. Yeah, I mean, I think you're talking 15 to 20%, which in rents is like a significant amount when you're selling things on a yield.
Oh yeah, I mean that can really
change everything 100%. So I think one of the things that I've learned is, so I'll go on and I'll look at the rent. So in this instance, I went on to see and I'm always conservative. So I want to see, so I'm going to look at what do not perfect looking units, not perfect looking buildings renting for in this area. And I'm looking within 6 blocks, really. Anything after 6 blocks, just on the internet, I'm not even going to take into account.
And typically you can find enough rental listings in 6 blocks to get a good enough feel?
Typically you can, yes. Yeah. And if not, then you just go to the closest thing that you can. But if I can't find an apartment building, because like it's different if I'm going to comp a 30-unit apartment building versus a duplex. Because duplex, normally people have more privacy, they have more space, they're larger. So normally a duplex rents more than an apartment. So I'm really trying to find a similar property. But if I can't, then I'm going to stretch and go to the closest rentable unit in the area.
Gotcha.
So what I found here was studios are going for $950. One bedrooms were going for $1,050 and two bedrooms, $1,295. Now, I definitely saw two bedrooms that were going for $1,450 and I definitely saw one bedrooms that are going for $1,150 and definitely saw studios over $1,000. But I don't want to underwrite that. I want to underwrite a realistic, almost worst case scenario that I know that we can hit. So that if Iran hits another one of our drones or there's some more bad political news that comes out or something, you know, whatever could happen in the next 6 months when I buy this building, that I can still count on what I'm going to get for rents. Because you never know what's going to happen. So you want to assume, you want to kind of plan for the worst, but still be somewhat realistic, but on the pessimistic side of realistic, if that makes sense. So then I get the rents here and I see that if I just hit those conservative rents, that I can increase the rent total, so the gross rents, by roughly $70,000, a little under $67,000. It looks like I can increase rents too.
Because what you're comparing, just give the numbers here, is the current total rents annualized are about $355,000 for the year. Mm-hmm. Your pro forma rents, which are the increased ones, are $421,000.
That's right.
So that's a big difference there.
Big jump. So what, I think we've talked about it before, but like every $100 that I raise rent a month is $20,000 on the back end per unit based on a 6% cap rate.
Yeah.
So every $100 is a big deal. And here we're raising rents on the studios $250. And on the one bedrooms, $250. So one bedrooms, $250, studios, $250. And on the two bedrooms, $195.
Okay.
So 30 units. Yeah. So every studio would be increasing $250. So on an annual basis, that ends up being $9,000.
Yeah, 9,000.
Yeah. So that's right. So that we did. Sorry, you made me second guess myself. And then on the one bedrooms, we're raising it $250. Times 11 times 12. So that's where we get the $20,000 increase there from the one bedrooms. And then on the two bedrooms, we're increasing $195 times 16 units times 12 months. And that gets us to $211,000 on the old rent, on the current rents, to $248,000 once we raise $195.
Okay.
So it's amazing how $100 a month and you have 30 units, you know, dramatically changes what you're going to collect. So then we go down to, now I'm going to underwrite the expenses. So that's the revenue. Now I'm going to underwrite expenses. So the management fee is taken off of rents collected. So basically you take this number, $421,440, and I subtract 5% for vacancy. And then that number, I take times 6%, and that gets me to $24,000. And that's just in the 6% management fee of rents collected. And then when I'm operating these units, we normally underwrite $2,500. Anything under 30 units, we think around $2,500 in legal. And if that is only if it's me and my partner doing the deal. If you're going to syndicate and you're going to have numerous partners, then obviously that's going to go up. If you're going to syndicate and you're going to have more than five partners, you're probably at closer to $10,000 in legal. We don't really syndicate a lot, so it's mostly just me and my partner. So that's normally, that's what we budget for legal, $2,500. But that would change if someone's syndicating or just bringing on more partners.
Okay.
So obviously the less you know someone and the more partners you're going to have, I'm not an attorney, but just naturally you want to have stronger language, stronger documents, and you're going to spend more in legal. And you should underwrite that here in the legal. Administrative, a deal like this, $5,000, that's just anywhere from, the bookkeeping to any office work, paying the bills, utilities, that kind of thing. Utilities here, this is for, so we do a RUB system. So we're charging tenants back for the utilities, water, sewer, trash. And then if there's parking, that's what you can charge for RUBs. So this is not that. This is just a common area utilities and overages. So if someone leaves the water running longer, this and this, if it doesn't fall into RUBs, this is what we're going to be expected to pay.
Okay. And so you're estimating about $3,600 a year for the common area
exactly.
utilities. Now, how'd you come up with that number?
We're normally at $10 per month on average per unit. So there's 30 units here, $300 a month, 300 times 12, $3,600.
So $10 per unit per month is your rule of thumb.
That's what we've seen play out. Yeah. We have, our data sample is we've probably bought and sold over 100 apartments in Denver. We've bought and sold over 350 in Des Moines. So we have, roughly 500 or 600 apartments as a sample. And that's what we've seen is roughly $10 per month per unit for overages and average and for common areas. And then trash. So trash is going to change depending on the size of the property. What we've seen is anything over 20 units. So it's like every 10 units should be around $150. So on properties we have that are 25 units right now, we're spending roughly 350. So this goes up a little bit more. So 400 per month, about 100 a week. So anywhere from between 50 and 100 a week, depending on the size of the property. And that's just for to have a 3-yard dumpster.
Okay.
And if the more people you have, obviously you have to come and change it more often. So, and that's one of the indicators, right? When you drive by a property, you look at the landscaping, you look at the windows, you look at the trash, right? And you can see how well run it is and what kind of property it is. And then tenants look at that as whether or not they want to live there. So obviously when we're trying to renovate and raise rents, that's something that we take very seriously, landscaping and the exterior of the property.
So you budgeted about $4,800 for the year for trash.
Yeah, $4,800. And then maintenance and repairs. So what's interesting is our model is to renovate every unit, lease it up, and then hold, and then we would sell in 24 months, roughly. So our maintenance is a little bit different. If we normally are at once we renovate, $50 per month per unit in labor and materials. So that's pretty low. The average on our long-term holds is closer to 85. So it just depends on your model. If you're going to hold and not renovate the units, you're going to be closer to 85. And if you're going to renovate, you should be closer to 50.
So I lost you somewhere in there. So an unrenovated unit, you budget $85 per month
per unit.
If it's renovated, you budget $50 a month per unit.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
That's right.
And that's for maintenance and also like capital expenditures, just everything?
So capital expenditures we're going to have down here in reserves.
Okay.
So this is just maintenance. This is like leaky toilet, leaky faucets.
So this is stuff just inside the unit.
Yeah, okay. Exactly. Yeah, that was a good differentiator. So then grounds, we have, this is lawn care and snow removal. This is really going to depend on how big the parking lot is and how big the lawn, if there's a lawn. We've done some dog parks. We've done some different, we've tried to xeriscape some. It really depends on the area. If it's close walking distance, people are going to have a lot of pets. You probably want to have a nice lawn. You want to have an area where they can take their pets out and go to the bathroom. It just really depends on the area and how big of a parking lot there is. You're going to have to shovel during the winter. So we put in $2,500 for the year. And there's no real secret to that. It's just you're going to have to. I think this is one of the reasons why you want to see a profit and loss, see what they spent before, see if there's some economies of scale there with other properties you own, or if you just want to xeriscape and get this number down.
So you're budgeting $2,500 a month or a year for Lawn care and snow removal?
Yes.
Okay.
So a little bit over $200 a month, basically.
That seems not that much for a 30 unit apartment building, but.
Yeah, there's
I guess
not there's not really
the
much. I think
whether...
they have some rocks there, and then there is a bigger, you know, there is a larger parking lot, but you know, we're normally paying per month in snow removal is about 100. So here we have budgeted 200.
Yeah. So and I guess if the lawn's a little bit bigger and the driveway or the parking lot's a little bit bigger, the costs don't go up exponentially.
They don't go up exponentially.
You got the service call out there.
Right.
Okay.
Property tax is just directly taken from the assessor's page. One interesting
so
thing
for
about
this property, $16,440.
One interesting thing here is because so many apartments are trading in Denver, being bought and sold, every 2 years, the state will reassess, and you should budget this to go up about 10% every 2 years. So if we were to hold longer than 2 years, we would budget, and we pro forma this out, we would budget that going up roughly $1,600 every third year. So that's something we've learned the last couple of years is the city of Denver and the suburbs are actively looking at that because values and because rents are going up, values are going up. So naturally taxes are going up and you should underwrite that if you're going to hold for longer than 2 years.
And that's for all real estate.
That's all real estate.
The houses we own and live in and condos, that's every 2 years they redo reassess
the value. Insurance, this is an interesting one with all the hail damage and all the storms we've had the last couple of years. Insurance has gone up 50%. And this is roughly $473 per unit. You could budget $500 per unit and be safe.
Wow.
And we have some economies of scale there with our relationships with vendors. But yeah, it's gone up a lot. The last units, the last buildings we've been buying, we've been shocked at some of the quotes we've been getting on insurance. So definitely take that into account. And it's just naturally they're having to pay out more premiums. And checks for everything getting done. So naturally, they're going to have to charge more to cover that.
Yeah, my insurance broker told me, because I just redid all my insurance like 2 months ago, she was telling me that basically on average, insurance companies, for every dollar they bring in for insurance, they're spending $1.25 for hail damage.
And that's because they have to cover overhead and stay in business, right?
So rates have to go up.
They have to go up, yeah. So here we get to total operating expenses of $91,062 and per unit of $3,035. And what you'll find in Denver is that anywhere between $3,000 and $4,000 a door per unit per year in expenses is an average.
Okay.
And because of, I think, just our experience, we're able to keep it closer to $30,000 on the lower end. The other figure that you can use as a barometer for where you're at is you're going to be somewhere between 25% and 30% of total gross revenue of rents as an expense ratio. So the closer you get to 20, obviously, the better operator you are, the better property you have, the closer you are to 30, obviously there's some fat there that you can trim. So here's where we get to your question on replacement reserves. So we budget $250 per unit per year.
$250 per unit per year.
Yes.
Okay.
And that's $7,500 for the year. And that covers anything exterior like you talked about. That's repaving the pavement. That's foundation. That's roof. That's HVAC. You know, if the boiler needs to get replaced, that's where that line item goes to make sure that you're saving for a rainy day when something comes out, when something big blows out. Other, you know, we budget evictions, and this is wrong. I don't know why I put five. It's $500. Sorry. It's $500 per eviction and four per year.
So $2,000 total.
$2,000, sorry.
Yeah.
You should budget on a property like this. We think every 30 units, you're going to evict four of those tenants.
Every year?
Per year.
Wow, really? It's that high?
Yeah, that's what we've seen.
Okay.
And especially in this area. So this is very hyper-local as well. This is one of the lower income suburbs. And I think Denver's probably three. You still, you know, even, yeah, I mean, evictions is definitely something you want to underwrite. And just when you factor in like the legal expense, I think you can do it for $250 to $300, but then you factor in the property management expense and then having to turn it, you know, there's definitely things that add up there. So we just budget $500 per eviction. And we think that every 30 units, we're going to have four of them in this location. So then that bumps the expense ratio to 23.86 and 33.52 per unit.
So overall, I mean, you're basically a 25% expense ratio.
Right.
Like that's still on the lower side.
That's on the lower side. Yeah.
For running a multi.
Right. Yeah. And we're still being conservative on rents. So we're trying to be conservative on expenses. So rounding up and taking worst case scenarios, and then we're being conservative on rents, and we get to, 25. So down here, so this is going to be different based on everyone's business model. Our business model is pretty heavy on construction, and we're trying to turn this. So we're trying to buy it, and we're trying to get as many units turned as we can. So roughly, we think half the building is going to be vacant for the whole year. So what we have here is, in the first year, we're not going to be able to raise all the rent. So basically, half the units are going to be vacant. So we're only going to collect half of what their current rent is. So we have $177,000 for gross income year one. So basically, we do, what are the current rents? What do we think we can get? What are the expenses that we can expect? And then down here, I'm going to put it all down to see what I'm actually going to have as net cash flow in every year. This is the third section of our underwriting. So year one, we have construction, year two is stabilized. So year one, we have $177,000 we're going to collect, which is basically just half of what their income was with their current rents. So then the management fees on that, collecting that rent is $18,000, which is just 6%, right? There's no lease up fees because we're not signing leases. When the leases come due, we're renovating the unit, not leasing it up. And then legal and administrative, so that's just straight from up top. Utilities and trash, this is a really high number, basically just because of all the vacancy we're going to have. So now instead of...
Because now you're paying utilities for the vacant room.
Exactly.
Yeah.
We're paying utilities for the vacant room.
So $27,600.
Yeah.
And what's your rule of thumb for pulling that out?
So basically the same thing, $200 per unit.
Okay.
$200 per unit per month, and we think half the units are going to be vacant at a time. And that's conservative because normally it takes us about, to turn a unit about 2 to 3 weeks, but to be conservative, we just say half the year, half the building's going to be vacant because it's going to take us that to turn it and then do the other units. So then we get down to utilities and trash. Okay, utilities and trash we did. And then we have maintenance and grounds. So here maintenance is low because we don't have units that are filled. So there is no maintenance. And then the grounds and repairs stays the same as above. And then real estate property tax, we just passed through because it's going to be the first 2 years we're going to be owning it. Insurance is the same. And then, so our operating expenses when half the building is vacant is $88,000. We still have the reserves, so we're still going to be putting money towards reserves. So we get an NOI, net operating income, of $81,808, which we're going to get to next, which on a $3 million purchase is very, very low. So then, what we like to do is, what is the mortgage going to be? What are we going to be paying? So right now, I just priced it out 2 weeks ago, and with a national lender, so this is not a federal loan. This is not Fannie or Freddie, but a national lender. So like Chase, Bank of America, Wells Fargo, one of the big five banks, they're offering right now, they're getting very aggressive on multifamily, and they're offering 25-year amortization. So basically the loan is paid back over 25 years, 3.9%. 5-year fix. So that means the interest rate is fixed for 5 years. And they will, based on our experience of renovations, they will give us 80% of purchase price, but there's no construction loan. So we are bringing 20% equity plus all the construction.
Okay.
And the reason why we do that is construction loans are very cumbersome. So even though we will get some more debt on the property and have to bring less cash, the process by which they come out and do draws is very cumbersome. So it prohibits our ability to be fast through construction, right? Because we want to pay our contractors quick. If our contractors know they're going to get paid quickly, then they're going to work faster. But if they know we have to wait for the bank to come out and inspect the work to get a draw, they're not going to work as fast. So we found that we'd rather just do all the construction ourselves. That's our business. That's what we know. So that could change for someone else that's not going to be doing as much construction. But
is this a balloon payment?
Because we're going to sell, so it's just fixed. So we have this interest rate is fixed for 5 years.
Okay.
So at the end of that, we would have to either refinance, sell. That's one of the two. Yeah.
Yeah,
it's fixed
okay.
for 5 years. Or it would go up to whatever the current interest rate environment is. So then we have mezz capital expense. So the reason, and mezz just means it's the difference. It's the difference between what the bank is going to lend and what we need to come in to close the property. That's what you call mezzanine capital, right? So we factor that at a 7% interest rate. And the reason we do that is, either we're going to cover that or we're going to have investors come in. Either way, we need to cover 7% hurdle.
Say this again. I did not understand this. So mezzanine capital?
Yeah.
This is totally a new word to me.
So mezzanine capital, so the bank is going to give you a first position debt, right?
Yes.
That's your first lien. And then on a capital stack to buy a property, your next, so everything between, so our purchase price on the property, we're trying to get it for $3.3 million, right? So the bank will lend 80% of that, which is, what is 80%? It's basically around $2.6 million. What does it say there? 3.3
times 80%.
Yeah.
Yeah, 2.6.
2.6. Okay. So the bank is going to give us 2.6. So that's our first mortgage, right? So to get from 2.6 to 3.3, that's called the mezzanine, the mezz piece. And there's different funds out there. There's investors, like, same thing with a flip, right? When you're coming in, normally, like, any hard money lender is going to cover 80 to 90% of the purchase. So that next 10 to 20% is the mezzanine piece.
So whether you're bringing your own capital or investors' capital, you're calling that the mezzanine.
The mezzanine debt, and that's 7%. So we always factor that at 7%.
And that's saying, so if you borrow that difference of that 20% of, whatever, I don't know, what's $800,000.
Right.
You got $74,000 budget on the line item. That's you paying 7% of that borrowed amount.
Exactly.
To the investor.
To the investor or ourselves.
To yourself. As, right. And you're doing that just calculating opportunity cost.
Exactly. So the thing is, most of the time we don't have other investors, so we just do it ourselves. But we still want to factor in this because, you know, if when we do bring on investors, they're going to want a 7% baseline hurdle. You know, they're going to want to at least know that they're making 7% in the deal. So we just baseline every deal we underwrite mezz at 7, you know, sometimes more depending on the deal, but on multifamily, it's about 7%.
Okay.
To know that so that's 74,000 interest. So that might be our capital. So we know, you know, so you have your first position mortgage, then you have the mezz at 7, and then year one with construction, we're at a negative $157,000 number. So we basically, in year one with construction, we are negative cash flow, $157,000. So that does not look good.
So where does that number, where does that money come from? That's just coming out of your guys' operating account?
Exactly.
Okay. Yeah. So there's no loan for that. That's you guys.
We just covered it. Yeah. And it's in it. Yeah. So it's out of this down payment in the construction. And then we understand that we're going to have to float $157,000.
Yeah.
So that's
so,
bad news.
Perspective though. Yeah. But you're also, I mean, rents are way down low.
Right.
Costs are way up. So that's just part of the cost.
That's just part of the
cost of
doing business. Yeah. So that's the bad news. So then now we get to some good news. So year two stabilized. So the construction's done. Now we have turned every single unit. Now we are able to rent the building for the rents we discussed at the beginning. Studios for $950, one bedrooms for $1,050, two bedrooms for $1,295. And again, that's conservative.
And so you're assuming by the end of year one, construction's done, everything's leased up, and year two is going to be everything's just marching
exactly
along.
Yeah, right. So we normally budget 6 months to do construction on the whole building and then 6 months to stabilize it, fill the building. Right. So then a year. So that's the first year. So then year two. So then now we already went over our expenses for year two. So now we can run the cash flow analysis here. So now we have the gross income, which is the rents collected from above that we factored. So 421,440. Vacancy. You know, vacancy in Denver has been at an all-time low, but we still want to budget 5%. So even though we should be less than that for vacancy, I think it's how, you know, some people can underwrite even more aggressively and put 7% if you want to be really conservative, but we have 5%. So that's 21,000. So then management fees. So this is on collected. So basically you take your income minus vacancy. You have that number. It's roughly 400,000. Then 6% of that is your management fee. You're going to pay on rents collected.
So about 24,000 bucks.
$24,000. And then lease up fees. So even though we do our own property management, we want to act as if we had to go out and hire someone to lease this up, what's that going to cost us? And pretty much any property manager worth their weight in gold is going to be, you're going to pay half the first month rent in a fee. So basically I just took half of each unit of what we're going to rent it for. And the total of that is $17,560.
And so that's assuming the cost for leasing up all the units for that 1 year.
Exactly. Yep. That's leasing up the entire building.
And then going forward, how do you calculate, like, if you want to, like, because this is year two, figuring year three, year four, year five, you know, hopefully year three, you're not leasing up 30 units again. I mean, what's your average turnover?
It's normally 25%. You're normally turning over 25% of the building, depending on how good of a property manager you are. Obviously, the better sense of community you build, which is where we get into, like, amenities, like, do you have a fire pit? Do you have swing sets for the kids? Do you have a playground? You know, this is where amenities come in, is you're going to have less turnover, the better amenities and the better job you do at creating community.
Okay.
Right? So which is where in some of the bigger complexes, you see them spending money on like coffee bars, on like a co-working space and a gym. You know, the more sense of community, the less turnover you should have. So, but what we've seen is 25%.
So going forward, if you got 25% of 30 units is like what, about seven units. So seven times the rent. So your lease up fee is going to be
significantly less.
Yeah. So what, four or five grand?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep. So legal, administrative. Once the building's stabilized, there's, you know, really it's just paying bills, processing an eviction thing. You know, basically $200 a month is what we, you know, when you have our business is this, so we just allocate that to our overhead. Right. So we have full-time people that do it and then we allocate per property.
And this includes evictions in there.
That's for processing. It's like what we would have to push the papers for. That doesn't include the legal and it doesn't include the property manager. That's just what we factor our time and whoever in our office that would handle that.
Gotcha. Okay.
And then we have utilities and trash here. So this is common areas again. And then we added the trash, which we had at $400 per month. So this is common area utilities, which we said is $10 per unit per month, plus the trash, which we said is $400 a month, basically $100 a week for this size of property. So we get to $8,400. And then maintenance and repairs. So we see that this has gone up 5X. And the reason is that maintenance, we said, once we've turned the units, so now every unit has new flooring, new paint, new bathrooms, new plumbing fixtures, new electrical fixtures. I mean, this unit is completely done. We should be at $50 per month per unit. And then you have, still have the ground. So we're still paying, what do we have for this? $2,500. So you still have $2,500 a year plus $18,000 in maintenance and repairs.
So $20,500 is what you're budgeting the whole year for maintenance and grounds upkeep. Okay.
That's right. And then the real estate property tax passed through. We said that the next year we would budget 10% above that. So the next year we'd be closer to, what is it, $1,600 above that. So we're closer to $18,000, right? We're at $16,440. Insurance stays the same. I think the same thing here. I think you should plan on raising this. If, you know, if there's hailstorms and more storms and damage, you're probably raising this 10 to 20% a year, depending on your relationship with the carrier and how many claims you filed. So now we have a total operating expense of $124,694, which is up from the previous year based on us filling the units. Transfer reserve stays the same. So it's going to be the same, $250 per unit per year. So now we get to the NOI, the net operating income of a stabilized property. We have $289,246. Now that's a good number.
Yeah.
That's a good number. So now we have our mortgage. Mortgage stays the same, right? It's fixed for 5 years. So that's $165,474, right? And then we still have our mez, right? So we still have the construction and the down payment that we have out there. That's the equity. So we still have the $1 million out, and at 7%, that's $74,000. So that's a lot of debt that we have out there. But we're going to cash flow after all of that $49,571.
So about $50,000 for the year.
$50,000 for the year, right? So now if you look at what I'm clearing on my 7% hurdle plus this, now that starts to make more sense, right? I'm going to pay myself or an investor 7%, and there's still cash flow left over to distribute, right? So that's what I would call. You know, this is a deal. This is one of the reasons why we're looking to do this deal is even after all the debt and the construction, and if we were to hold this, right? So one of the things would be, well, you could do here, we would probably choose to sell this unless we really like the development going on in the area, right? But if we were going to hold it, then what you could do is refinance the property, do on long-term government debt, right? And they would give you probably 80% of appraised value. And this property should appraise for, you know, they're going to do it at probably a 6% cap rate. So this property should appraise for somewhere between 4.5 and 4.6 million. So you're going to pull out a lot of your equity. So you're going to be into this deal almost no cash, and you're still going to be cash flowing because your debt service is going to go down.
And because you'll take that refinance, pay off the original mortgage, and then pay off your mezzanine investors.
Exactly. Pay off our investors or return our capital, go do another deal, right? So then the other things that this did not include is depreciation and principal pay down. So we would sell this so the depreciation doesn't come into effect as much, but we still would pay down $65,000 a year in principal. So even though the first year we lost roughly $60,000, I'm gonna pay down the mortgage, basically what I owe to the bank by $130,000 roughly, right? So that almost washes out. And then the depreciation, and you can speak more to this I just listen to a really good podcast from you on depreciation and the differences that, you know, the government has done different things with bonus depreciation. There's all kinds of creative things you can do with depreciation.
Yeah, it's amazing what you can do.
There's so much. Yeah, we were just talking about that. But basically, at its minimum, if you take the value of the building, which is $2.6 million, divided by 27 and a half years of that the government will allow you to depreciate it, you're getting $96,000 a year in depreciation. So even if you held this building and your cash flow increases, you're going to be able to show a loss on the building for a long time to come. So that's good news, right? If you're going to hold the building, we're going to sell it, like we said, so the depreciation doesn't come into effect as much, but we still take it into account. It's still noteworthy, right? So one of the things, since our business model is really to buy, renovate, and then stabilize and sell, this is the summary up here. So we look at a preferred purchase price is what we're trying to buy it for, $3.3 million. Closing fees are normally 1% of the purchase price. So we have $30,000 there. Closing prepaids is just what the bank is going to hold in escrow. They're going to hold property taxes and hazard insurance. So that comes out to roughly $20,000. And then property preparation, this is just what it's going to cost us to clear the building. Basically help the tenants find another place to live, or if we have to evict, cash for keys, those kind of things. So $5,000. Construction we have at $400,000. So roughly $10,000 a unit plus $100,000 in capital improvements.
Okay.
So we have 400 there. So then we get to a total of $3.7 $5 million, $3,754,625, $3.7 million. So that is what we would have into the building, right? And then we come back down to our NOI. So the way that, so single family homes buy and sell based on what the comps are, mm-hmm. right? What owner occupier is willing to pay for it, right? So apartments trade on what the yield is, what it's going to return. And that's just called a cap rate. The way that brokers in our, you know, society does this, or the way that people in real estate factor, you know, determine value as NOI. So you take our NOI, which we got from below, which is $289,000. And conservatively at a 6.5 cap. So basically, to put it into perspective, like LA trades at like a 3% cap rate. New York trades at like a 2% cap rate. Basically, people would rather put their money there than in a bank and get in a money market, right? That's basically what it is. They'd rather buy an apartment building and get a 3% return, right? That's basically, cap rate just means return. What's my capital going to return, right? So the bigger the metropolis and the more attractive, basically the lower the cap rate, mm-hmm. the more aggressive that investors are willing to get to buy that, because basically they would think that it's stable. It's more secure. People are willing to buy a New York, a Brooklyn or Manhattan apartment building and get a 2% return because they think it's stable. They think that it's not going anywhere. And Denver, back in the day, so 2008, 9, 10, used to trade at a 7 or an 8% cap rate. In today's world, it's trading more at a 5 or a 6. So conservatively, again, if things were to change, so we underwrite it at a 6.5.
So realistically, it'll probably sell around a 6 cap or even a little lower.
Realistically, a turnkey unit like this, and with the building and the location, I think it could be more like a 5.5% cap rate, but I put 6.5 just to be safe, right? So at a 6.5% cap rate, the day that I'm done and it's leased up, it's going to be worth $4.49 million.
And if the cap rate actually is at a 5.5, that increases the value.
It's going to be worth, yeah, like 4.7, 4.8. It increases the value. So as cap rates go down, the price of the building goes up. That's a good kind of barometer for everyone listening. So then in 2020, once it's stabilized and it's seasoned, and with rents being able to increase, right, because I'll be able to increase the rents one time, we think the building would be worth closer to 4.6, so 4.584, and that's still at a 6.5% cap rate. And obviously, if that went down, then the value would go up.
So on here, like, what do you look at to say, okay, we like to buy this deal? Is it the cap rate? Is it the net cash flow? Is it the exit? Like, what do you look on here to say, cool, this meets our underwriting guidelines, right, to pull forward and, you know.
That's a great question. So the way we look at it is, what's my total return on capital, right? So if I'm going to deploy basically equity, so $600,000 to purchase the building plus $400,000 in renovation, right? So I'm going to deploy $1 million. What is that going to return me, right? So we already went down here and saw that it would return to me, you know, I would be able to pay 7% yield and still return $50,000, mm-hmm. right? So roughly that would be $120,000 on $1 million. So that'd be like 12%, right, on the cash. If it was all my cash, after it stabilized, it would return to me 12%.
I mean, I'm not a multifamily expert here, but that seems like an outrageous
number. That's a ridiculous return, yeah, like, in Denver. That's a ridiculous return.
If you don't want that, pass
yeah,
on to
you
me.
Should not get into, yeah, you should get out of real estate if that's not what you're looking for. So I look at that. So that's one of the things. I want to know, if I had to hold the building, what is it going to return on my cash, right? So that's one. And then the second thing I'm looking at is my total cash. So if I'm in $1 million, right? So I bought it for 3.3 and I can sell it conservatively for 4.6, right? That's a great return on my capital.
Because you're basically, so that's...
I spent $1 million. Yeah. So I spent $1 million. So 3.3 and I'd list it. So you're probably listing it at 4.6, right? After closing costs and everything, you're probably netting 4.45, right? and you're clearing, and then your debt is 2.6 million, right? So you're going to return after everything, probably $800,000. So I'm going to invest $1 million and probably return somewhere net between $700,000 and
$800,000. Wow. Okay.
Right? Because your debt on this, we already said, with the bank is going to be 2.6, right?
Yeah.
So you're going to sell this thing at 4.6.
And that's including paying off your mezzanine capital and all that?
Yeah. So then you pay off your $1 million and then after everything, you're probably going to have $800,000 left. $700,000 to $800,000. That's conservative, right? Because this could go up, right?
Yeah.
If interest rates continue to go down, right, and rents continue to increase, right, and let's say we were able to rent the building for a little bit more, right? So every $100 more is $20,000 per unit that it's worth, right, each unit. So as rents go up and debt goes down, then the cap rate's going to go down, and then the value of the building goes up, right?
Yeah.
So the punchline is, as rents go up and interest rates come down, the value of the building increases. So naturally, and the environment we're in, where the Fed is talking about cutting interest rates, right? And we look at, there's a shortage of affordable housing. So we think that rents could go up. Naturally, I feel really good about a 6.5% cap rate. I think that's pretty conservative.
So you mentioned, like, I get the cash on cash return you're talking about. I get the amount of money you clear. Do you have like minimums that you say, hey, we want to see 8%, 10%? Like, what's the minimum? Or does it just depend on the deal and the location?
Right.
And because, I mean, you know, a property in, you know, one part of town has different long-term upside than a property in another side of town.
Yeah.
Like, so how do you, what are your
rules?
How
do we determine?
Yeah.
So it really comes down to, because we don't syndicate, we haven't taken, you know, only on one deal have we syndicated and done it and done a deal with an institutional investor. Most of it has just been me and my business partner. But so we look at, What are the other deals we have right now that we want to do, right? So I look at opportunity costs. If there's not a lot of deals, then obviously I would take less than a 12% return and less than $800,000 net return on my $1 million, right? And that's going to be closer to like 18 months. So that's not quite it. So it's kind of going to be closer to like a 40% annualized return on cash. But our threshold really is anything over 30% annualized on our money, we will really look at. And then from there, we look at opportunity costs. What other deals are there? How do we like the area?
Mm.
What does the environment look like? How do we feel about holding this thing for 2 years? If we had to hold it, would this be? So then other variables come in. And I would just encourage, you know, listeners, it really comes down to having a strategy. You got to know your cash position. Like, you know, how much cash do you have? And what are you looking to do with it? You know, if you're going to be a passive investor, you know, a 7% to 8% return is phenomenal, right?
Yeah, you're not going to get that 30%.
You're not going to get it exactly. Now, this is what I do full time. So now I'm looking at, and my phone rings every day with new opportunities. So naturally, I'm having to compare buildings based through that lens. Is if I say yes to this deal and I put $1 million in this deal, what deal am I going to have to say no to tomorrow that could be better? And so I'm just looking at that. So I kind of look at the time of year. I look at the environment. I look at, you know, the relationships that I've built. I've looked at, you know, the people that are bringing me deals, the, you know, how many deals are we currently managing, you know, all those kind of things. But I'd say for us, anything over 30% annualized on our money, we're going to take a hard look at.
And that's for you, assuming like you're going to buy it, rehab it, stabilize it,
and sell it. Right.
Okay.
Right.
And worst case scenario, if you hold on to it, it's cash flowing.
And we're going to have it. You're going to have a better, yeah. We're going to have a good, yeah. And we're going to be able to get our money out, right?
Yeah.
At the end of 2 years, let's say the market turns, I would refinance and then have that capital to either redeploy or sit on and then still have a cash flowing asset.
So how'd you learn to do all this? Just read books, go to seminars, or just try and true and you take your black eyes as you do business?
I paid $25,000 for a mastermind. Just kidding. I did not do that. There's really good masterminds out there, so that could be one avenue. So the best book out there
Dude,
on this...
Do not spend $25,000 and learn how to underwrite a deal.
You could contact Chris and we could grab coffee and do it for free. So the best book on this that I've read is Joe Fairless's book, the best ever, you know, apartment book. I think it's called Best Ever Book. I don't know, apartment.
I think all the stuff is called Best Ever.
Best Ever, yeah. Joe Fairless is best. But that's a really good book. But we learn through trial and error, basically, is the answer. Like, we learn by understanding that, hey, we bought this building, we thought we were going to sell for this. Okay, we should underwrite this and do this next time. Oh, we thought we could rent for this. Oh, we didn't. Let's be more conservative. Oh, we drove, we looked at apartments within a mile of this. Oh, we really shouldn't do that. It's got to be more hyper-local. So it's just, you know, and in 2 years, you and I'll do something else and I'll be coming to you saying, hey, you know what? In the last 2 years, I've learned this and this is how I'm underwriting now. But over the last 2 or 3 years of focusing on multifamily and really in the last year being hyper-focused on it, this is kind of where we've gotten to. And we're really just trying to simplify it. You know, other people can have a much more cumbersome and way more, you know, they can have multiple spreadsheets to get to this. You know, we just try to simplify it to say, if we think that rents are this now and we think that we can get it here tomorrow, right, what is it going to cost us to do that? And what is the return on our capital going to look like? And if we had to hold it, what's that going to look like? And if we sold it, what's it going to look like? And just try and be as conservative as possible.
So, I mean, one of the reasons I like this is it's for a spreadsheet, it's actually fairly simple.
Right.
Like, it's not super complex. You don't have 3,000 variables in there.
Right.
Because I see a lot of times people, you know, they get so detail-oriented right. on the underwriting that they kind of get stuck in this, what they call it, the paralysis by right. analysis.
They're just so
mindset.
Busy underwriting.
Yeah.
They have so many spreadsheets, so many boxes to fill, so many things. You know, for me, it's one page here. I put all the numbers on this. It takes me about an hour once I have all the data to really look through this. And then, you know, like I said, I'm going to create this. Then I'm going to go drive the neighborhood. I'm going to see what it looks like around six blocks, right? I think that's one of the keys for me is you got to be really good on the rent study. You got to be very specific on the area, on the neighborhood, and then you can create the pro forma accordingly. And I think there's nothing wrong with asking for help. I think there's definitely people in my life that I could call and ask for help. But the one thing you can't do is just rely on brokers. You know, their job is to sell properties.
Mm-hmm.
So I think one of the biggest pieces of advice is, you know, they're going to send you a bunch of information and it's fine to look at it, but you kind of want to look at it, throw it out the window, and then go create your own pro forma. You know, do not take, and you want to do this yourself. And I think the more you do this, the better you're going to be at it. You know, so I actually enjoy doing this stuff because it sharpens my pencil and helps me get better at underwriting.
How many deals a week or a month do you underwrite, do you say?
I don't know, probably five a week.
Okay.
So 20, yeah, it's between 20 and 25 a month.
I mean, so that's
easily.
That's a
yeah.
good hefty
right.
amount because
yeah.
this isn't a 5 minute
oh, yeah.
analysis.
No, for sure, yeah.
Okay.
No, and there's, you know, like in a four unit, you know, someone could call me with a four unit, give me an address and the purchase price, and I could pretty much say yes or no on the phone and be 95% right on a four unit. When you get over four units, you really want to have a spreadsheet, you want to have a system, and I just follow the same system every time. I'm going to get, you know, the three things I'm going to do. I'm going to ask for the trailing, I'm going to ask for the profit and loss. I'm going to get the rent roll. I'm going to do a rent study, right? I'm going to drive that area and then I'm going to create a pro forma and see if it pencils out. But those are the three things that I do and just try and simplify it.
So what are the
so
the
I'm going to get
things?
I'm going to get the profit loss statement
profit loss.
And the rent roll. So that's
okay.
one. I'm going to get the due diligence docs, those things, right? And then I'm going to do a rent study. I'm going to go on HotPads, go on Zillow, go on apartments.com and see what rents are in that area.
Okay.
Right? So then I'm going to do a rent study and then I'm going to drive. After I look at the rent study, if I'm like, oh, these rents could make sense and this makes, you know, let me go drive it. Let me go get a feel. And when I say drive, I'm probably spending an hour driving the neighborhood. I'm going to drive everything six blocks around there each way to see what's around there. What other apartments buildings are like? Are they being renovated? Are they not? What amenities are around there? What's walking distance? What coffee shops? What schools? Parks? Everything, you know, like that. Because that's going to matter. It's hyper. The thing with apartments rents is it's hyper local. You got to think six blocks or less. If what you're thinking outside that, you're rolling the dice. And people could disagree with that. They could say 12 blocks. I think you want to be very, very specific. And so the more micro you get with your rent study, the more conservative you're going to be.
So let me ask you this, because I mean, you've done a lot of stuff in the multifamily world, you know, single family
right.
world. And so the rents for multifamilies are more hyper-local than single family stuff is what you're,
absolutely.
What you're seeing?
Absolutely. 100%. Yeah. 100%.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So the three things to go back, I'm going to get the profit loss. I'm going to do a rent study. I'm going to drive the neighborhood. So rent study includes driving, right?
Okay.
So I'm going to do the rent study. I'm going to get on HotPads, get on Zillow. People starting out, you should look three sites. I right now just like HotPads. I just like the website. I like the way it functions. It fits my eye.
What about like Rentometer?
Rentometer.
Or Rentometer, I don't know how you
yeah,
say
it. You really want to be on a site with multiple apartments in that area and you want to be comparing that site with other sites. I haven't done much with that.
Okay. Well,
I think
it's a paid service. I haven't found you, so I'm just curious about you because
I don't,
ton of stuff.
I'm very frugal. I'm from the Midwest. I don't, I'm trying not to pay for sites. So free sites for me.
Yeah.
So
I agree with you. The free sites are great.
Yeah. I'll have to look into that. I haven't ever used
and
it.
Zillow
so I can't
is like
comment.
The biggest rental data company out there.
Zillow and Facebook now, yeah. Facebook Marketplace.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, we do a lot on Facebook Marketplace. But so you're going to do your rent study. So that means studying websites that have rentals that are free, and then you're going to drive the neighborhood. And I would focus on six blocks. What's six blocks radius of the building? And then from there, I'm going to create my pro forma based on what I just underwrote with rents and what I drove. Sometimes when I get back from driving the property, I'm like, I can't get those rents, right? There's no way I can do it. So I'm going to create the pro forma. If the pro forma makes sense, and I think I can hit my numbers, then I'm submitting an offer that fits the pro forma, right? So we submitted an offer here for 3.3. That's where we want to be. And obviously, based on this, we know that there's a little bit of wiggle room, but we're trying to stick to that number. So then you submit the offer, you negotiate from there. But this, creating the pro forma first helps give you, it's kind of like your North Star with negotiating because it tells you what you can go to.
Yeah.
Because then you just plug in new numbers. If I type in 3.5 million there as a purchase price, I see that my return goes significantly down and now it's not as attractive. So you want to do it. For me, it helps me in that order because I can negotiate based on knowing how much room I have to negotiate once I already know the pro forma, once I know the numbers.
So what's a good starting point? Because a lot of people out there getting into investing in general.
Right.
And a lot of people, as you know, like multifamily syndication is the hot thing now. A lot of people want to get into that. So regardless of, or just based on people's interest when they're starting out, what are some good resources for people to get started on understanding the numbers and underwriting and all this stuff?
I think, there's some really good podcasts out there that I've listened to in the past. I would listen to podcasts. I would read. I think that book was really good. I think that's the best book. I've read three or four different, and kind of when I say read, I've like flipped through, but the best ever one has a lot of really good information. He's done thousands of units. So I thought that was really helpful. And I think just, for me, I do things based on relationships. So for me, I like taking someone to lunch or coffee, picking their brain, asking them questions and those kind of things. I think, if you're starting out, you want to talk to someone that's done it before. And then I think from there, you want to build relationships with brokers to try and find deals. And even before that, you have to get pre-approved. You have to find your source of capital. You either have to have the money or know someone that has it and get pre-approved because you don't want to waste anyone's time if you know you can't come up with the money. So, but for those of you out there that are pre-approved and want to get into apartments, I think the number one thing is find someone that's done it before that can kind of help guide you through it. It doesn't have to cost a lot of money. I mean, relationships can go a long way. I think one of the coolest things about real estate is just being able to collaborate. Like, hey, I have this. Maybe you have some capital. Someone else has done apartments and they may need capital. You don't have to pay for everything. I think there's a lot of things that can be done just with good energy, synergy, and relationship, just fundamental skills. I have something and I really want to do something. You have the experience. I have the capital. Maybe we can help each other.
So I got a random question here for you, Terrence. Just since we kind of talking about multifamily stuff and you've been, you've done different facets of real estate investing now. Do you think there's one best path for people getting started? Because I read some people or read some books or hear some people say, hey, skip single family, go straight to multifamily, go straight to the big stuff. Other people say, start small, go up. I mean, do you have any advice out there?
Right.
Because that was definitely a question I asked myself years ago as I was getting into this.
Right.
And I came down to, my preferences and my determination. Right. I'm kind of curious to hear about, because you've been doing this now for, 10 years.
Right. Yeah.
You're getting some gray on your
I think, yeah,
hair
I got
from
gray,
real estate investing.
It's terrible.
So
that might be the daughter, though. But yeah.
Does it make a difference, or is there like one better path, or is it just one of those things like it just depends on like 3,000 other things?
I wouldn't be where I'm at if I wouldn't have started flipping houses. I thought that was a great way to learn real estate and a great way to understand investing and dealing with contractors. And, because of my age and my energy and kind of what I enjoy doing, I like rolling up my sleeves. I like being able to take on projects that are really messy and dirty and have a lot of problems. But that's not for everybody. I mean, that's definitely, we were just talking, it's definitely stressful. There's a lot of fires. So, Grant Cardone would say, just buy 500 units. And, he's a big proponent of start, go big or go home. I just think, everything is a stepping stone. Everything in my life has been, I did one thing. I kind of learned it. I made some mistakes. I figured out there. And then I took another step and took another step. And as I look back, everything's kind of built on each other. It's been just one, it's building blocks. So for me, I wouldn't be able to do what I'm doing without having started with flipping houses.
Yeah.
And I think that has led me to kind of where I'm at now, where I really enjoy multifamily. I see myself doing this for a long time. But at the same time, I want to be flexible. Maybe there's going to come opportunity in 3 or 4 years where it's like, hey, I really want to get into mobile homes, or I really want to get into storage, or I think that this fits my lifestyle better, And maybe what'll allow me to be successful in that space, let's say self-storage, will have built on what I learned in the apartment world, and from multifamily.
It's interesting you said the go big or go home quote, which that quote I'm not a fan of,
right?
Because that's a lot of times people say it sounds really cool. Hey, cool, go out there and just go knock it out of the park.
Right.
The problem is way more people go home than go big.
Right.
In that.
Exactly.
Yeah, I mean, that's my experience.
Right.
I've definitely done that before, swung the bat and whatever.
100%.
Yeah, I like what you said, Joe. Just kind of starting out, take the opportunity, build, and every year it's going to be different.
And the other thing is when you get into apartments, there's a lot of risk. When you buy a, let's say you buy a $400,000 flip, it's not going to ruin your life if you don't make money, or maybe you lose 20 grand, or maybe worst case scenario, you lose 50 grand, but you can recover from that. If you get into buying a $3 million property and you don't know what you're doing, it can get ugly really quick. You know, I think the monthly payment on this thing is like 15,000 or something, 13,000. I mean, if you don't know how to lease things up, I mean, that can get ugly really quick if you're having to float that. So I just think everything builds on its own. You know, we've lost money with single family. We learned, we've improved. We've lost money with multifamily. We've learned, we've improved. And now we're able to do bigger deals and it kind of just builds upon itself. But there's nothing wrong with like starting out, you know, partnering on a rental, partnering on a flip, partnering on something small, maybe partner on a condo, you know, just there's nothing wrong with getting started. I think the key is just to get started. And that's what I would encourage people is multifamily can be amazing. It can be one of the best decisions you ever make, but there's nothing wrong with starting out with a condo, starting out investing with someone else, starting out maybe being the mezz capital for someone else just to say, hey, I have capital. I want to invest. I just want to learn. I've had people approach me, you know, hey, listen, I have capital. I just want to learn from you. Can I just invest and watch you? You know, so there's nothing wrong with any of that. I think what I would encourage, you know, I'm a doer. Like, I think I would just encourage people to get out there and do something.
I think that's a perfect note to end the podcast on because I 100% agree with you. Go out there, do a deal, and do something.
And I'm going to go walk a property.
Perfect. All right, Terrence, thank you.
All right, we'll see you. Thanks, Chris.